Notes, I had to switch in the middle of the song. So whenever I do that, sorry, I probably do it quite a bit, because there's a point where I can't go above, and that's that. Or else I'll start to cough. We have a couple things to start off with. So, being Father's Day, if we got this card, who would we think it's to? Anybody got a guess who might get this card? Solomon. You're right. If we opened up the card, it might look like this. Yeah, that's Solomon wishing. What's his dad's name? David. Happy Father's Day. Solomon wishing David. Oh, no, this is Solomon's Father's Day card from one of his sons. Yeah. He could have had a lot of sons. You'll find out later in the message. Okay, how about this one? Oh, maybe this is the one. Does anybody have any clues off of the cover who this card might be to?
David,
yeah. Man after God's heart's got to give it away, right? And if you opened it up, it might look like this. Maybe Solomon gave it to him. Or Absalom. Maybe that's Absalom, but he got a haircut if it is. How about this one? Who do you think could have gotten this card? Who? Jonah? Might be Jonah? Let's open it up and see. Yeah, this one got changed. Yeah. I don't know what Jonah's son's name was, but this could have been his Father's Day card. How about this one? Happy Father's Day. You're not just any dad. You're a man of faith and blessings, a husband, a father, a dreamer, a wrestler, blessed by God. Who is it? Jacob, you're saying? Alex said Jacob. He got it right. Happy Father's Day, Jacob. He probably would have gotten how many Father's Day cards?
A lot.
Yeah, at least 12. How about this one? Happy Father's Day. Thank you for leading us, loving us, teaching us to play the trumpet. The best dad ever. Who do you think this one would be to? There's a couple clues in there. Teaching us to play the trumpet, leading us. Any guesses?
Joshua?
Let's see. Oh, it is. Happy Father's Day, Joshua. Yeah, how do you like them apples? What? Okay, enough fun for now. That was kind of fun. So the name of the message this morning is The Glory of Solomon. He was one of the cards there. So we've been reading about Solomon and the temple he had built. In our daily readings, I don't know how many of you guys are following along in the reading of the Bible. I think a fair number are. But right now we're reading about Solomon and the building of the temple and his, if you're in the chronological plan, it's right in the heart of it right now where we're reading. And there is a lot of information packed in that account. And it's quick to read through it, but all the stuff that went on is a lot of stuff that went on. And I thought it would help sink in if we could visualize some of it. So if we can visualize something, sometimes it helps us to add perspective to the story, and it also helps us see how important the different events are. And to me, the story of Solomon is interesting. When I was a younger kid reading it, maybe Malachi, what grade are you in?
Sixth.
Malachi's age, maybe a little bit younger. I remember reading through the story of Solomon, and I was confused about his character. When I was his age, I read through the Bible maybe the first time, and it was kind of impressive, and I thought about those characters and the different things they said and did, and when I got to the Solomon part of the Bible, I was confused about what kind of a person he was. And back then, when I was young, I got the impression that he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Do we still use that phrase? Born with a silver spoon? They're saying no. So if you're younger, a more modern version of the same phrase might be, he was born on third base. You get that one? Yeah, he gets that one. So the young people might think he was born on third base. And the older people, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Both phrases imply that not a lot of effort is needed to succeed. That's kind of what that phrase means. You can succeed without a lot of effort, maybe because of the people around you, maybe because of what you were given, or maybe you just had so much talent that things came easy to you. Success comes very easy to these people. Do you personally know someone like that? That success comes to very easily? I know somebody like that, or I know a couple people like that. Well, in the story of Solomon, and even just a little bit before, the Bible says that David wanted to build a house for God according to 2 Samuel 7. David was not satisfied to have a house of his own, but the Ark of the Covenant to be staying in a tent. So that rubbed David wrong, that he had a house to live in, and the Ark of the Covenant, which was where God stayed during the time of the Exodus, was living in a tent. So David thought it was an injustice, like God was being treated second class. So he wanted to build a house for God, or a house that was called by God's name. So at that point, when David wanted to do this, God made a covenant with David. And included in that covenant was a promise of David's descendant after him. He would build a house for the Ark of the Covenant and for the name of God. So it was David's dream, but it was brought forth through his son. And this information is taken from 2 Samuel 7. The covenant is much bigger than that, than what I just mentioned, that he just wanted to make a house. The covenant was more involved, and it had more facets to it, but what I just mentioned is part of the covenant, that his son would build a house that would be called by the Lord's name. So David lined up most of the supplies before he died. David was king of Israel. So that his son Solomon could proceed and easily build it. So maybe that's why I got that impression when I was a little kid, that things went easily for Solomon. He was to build the temple of God, but all the stuff was sitting right there. David gathered it all up and had the plans and other things about it as well. So Solomon built, or had it built, the first temple in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, the exact site chosen by his father David. It is Father's Day, right? Happy Father's Day, by the way, you guys. Everybody else already, they already heard it, but happy Father's Day. So, and David's father, of course, of Solomon. So it's kind of like, it fits a little bit. So David picked the site, Mount Moriah. It's the threshing floor. It's where David saw the angel that was going to destroy Jerusalem, and God withheld the angel from destroying Jerusalem when David was given three choices about how Israel would be punished for him counting the people. That's the spot where he chose to have the temple built. Also, the spot where Isaac was to be offered by Abraham in that story. It's in the same spot. So the construction took place between the 4th and 11th year of Solomon's reign. And the project was magnificent. It took 7 years to complete, and it was heavily adorned with cedar, fir, and solid gold. And the record of its building is found in 1 Kings 6 and also in 2 Chronicles 2 through 9. Now, in the old days, they would weigh things and call them a talent. So when you read talent in the Bible, it's a weight. So they're saying there's so much weight. A talent in the ancient is supposed to be about 75 pounds. So one talent equals 75 pounds. That's more than I can even lift. I used to be able to, but now Alex lifts it for me. So according to 1 Chronicles 22, David gathered 100,000 talents of gold. Now, I'm not a mathematician very much, but sometimes I can do math. And they also gathered, David gathered, 1,000,000 talents of silver. So you math people are probably, the numbers are whirring in your head. Whirring, W-H-I-R, that kind of word. So 100,000 talents of gold is 3,050 tons in U.S. tons, the 2,000 pounds. So there were 3,750 tons of gold. Or if you were to take the gold and put it into a cube, it would be 19 feet cubed of solid gold. I think this ceiling is like 13 feet or 12 feet something. I can't remember. But it would be past the ceiling in a cube. One solid cube, 19 feet. I think that's a lot of gold. And for the silver, it's 37,500 tons. Of U.S. tons, of the 2,000-pound tons. Or one cube, 50 feet on each side. I'm pretty sure that this length is 70 feet. Am I right, Timothy? This is 70 feet? Yeah. This wall, the long wall, is 70 feet. So take 20 feet off. We'll mark it like at the middle of the double doors there. So the silver amount would be from the crack of the double door all the way to the windows in a cube, that tall, that way, this way. That's a lot of silver. It's an amazing amount of silver and gold, if you ask me, just for this one project, building the temple. David already had accumulated it before Solomon was even king, because he wanted to build it, but God wouldn't let him. That certainly would make a lot of jewelry, I think. Or, if you were about to retire, probably you could retire on that much. Maybe. But there were also other precious stones and metals gathered, and particular wood, in addition to the gold and silver. There was a lot of bronze gathered up and things like that, and different types of wood that David had gathered up to build the temple. Was David a control freak or something? Because Solomon was supposed to build the temple, right? But David gathered up all this stuff for him to build it and gave him, he gave him the plans as well. And he also arranged all the people to make the temple an operating institution. David did all this before he died. He said, okay, you're going to build this temple, and here's all the stuff, and here's all the people that are going to run it. Thousands of people to serve as the temple staff. Year-round, they would take shifts. You know, 4,000 of this would do this for so many months. 4,000 different people would do this for so many months. He set it up before the temple was even built, that there would be a staff that would allow the temple to run as a smooth institution. That was just after it was built. To build it, Solomon, did he hire them or were they slaves? 150,000 workers to build the temple. It seems like a lot to me because it was a big building, but it wasn't a skyscraper. It was 90 feet high on the inside in the main part of the room. 150,000 workers were used with 3,600 supervisors plus one more guy. There was one more guy added to that. His name was Hammurabi. And he was sent from the king of Tyre because he was a skilled man and endowed with understanding. He knew how to work gold. He knew how to work silver. He knew how all the construction was. And so the king of Tyre sent this one man to oversee the project to make sure that everything was done. And you might say that 150,000 workers is an awful lot of workers, but all of the parts of the temple were prepared off-site and transported and then assembled. Some of the stones that were in the foundation of the temple were 60 feet long. How many guys would it take to carry a 60-foot long stone that's like this big square? It's as long as that wall. It probably would take the 150,000 just to lift it up. So there were people to transport. There were people to shape the stones, and they worked in the quarries where the stones were quarried and brought them to the site, and they all fit together. They had to size them, square them, and shape them at the quarry. And then they were transported to where the temple would be built. The ornate gold and bronze and silver that were made into big items that were cast into big items with a foundry where they would heat the gold and liquefy it and pour it into a mold and break away the sand from the mold and then have their finished product, and I'm sure it would have to be polished and cleaned and all that. That was all done in the desert, and they brought those big pieces to the temple when they were ready to be assembled. I don't know how big this is for you guys, but I have a picture of, this is the rose version of what the temple would have looked like, what Solomon's temple. You can see the inside is all covered with gold. And it was made of wood and overlaid with gold. So it took a lot of people and know-how and on how to make it happen and be the building that it became. This is the rose version, and this is the Rose Temple Tour. So this is one of those books. Floyd has one of them, but this one's about other stuff than the one Floyd has. This one has a picture of Solomon's Temple. You can see up in the corner it says Solomon's Temple. And then here's a little bit about it. Okay, number one, you see a number one on this picture up here? That's the bronze altar. So bronze was one of the materials. That's a big deal right there. That was cast into a piece and brought to the site. They, in the desert, melted the bronze, made a form, poured it in there, and made this big cauldron. God required the people regularly to sacrifice a perfect animal for their sins. The blood of the animal justified the people before God and restored their relationship with him. And that's where they did that, at the bronze altar outside the building. Number two, if you see number two on there, it's probably near number one. It kind of progresses 1 through 12 across the side. Number two is the person bringing the offering put his head on, or put his hand on the head of the offering or the animal while it was killed, symbolically putting his sins on the animal and the animal dying in their place. That's how the sacrifice was working for the Jews back then. And this was their first brick and mortar building before it was a tent, don't forget. Number three is the sea, or the bronze basin. It was cast of bronze too. The priests washed themselves at the basin, purifying themselves before entering the temple. It was about 15 feet across, and it held more than 10,000 gallons of water, and it stood on bronze oxen. And in the Bible, it says that the thickness of the wall of that cauldron or kettle was a hand breadth. So this is how thick the material was that bowl was made of. It was cast into that shape. Number four, there are two pillars. You see them there? Under the porch. They call that part the porch. The bronze pillars are called Jachin on the right and Boaz on the left, and they supported the roof of the porch, and they were 27 feet high. And they were bronzes, or they were brass. So brass or bronze. Well, bronze has brass in it. And the two names, Jachin, it means the one on the right was Jachin, and the one on the left was Boaz. And I thought it maybe had something to do with Ruth and Boaz, but it's just the meanings of the names. Jachin means he establishes, inferring that God establishes. And Boaz means in him is strength. In God is strength. So God establishes and God has strength. That was at the entrance to the temple. And number five is the holy place. The holy place, only priests were allowed to enter the holy place, and they did it every day. And there are things in there that they attended to. Number six had 10 gold lampstands and 10 tables for bread that were made for the temple. And you can see them in there. They're not very big compared to the tables there, and the lampstands are sticking up. This is 90 feet high in here. And these walls are all overlaid with gold. There were palm trees carved in there. Well, it was carved in wood and then overlaid with gold, but there are all kinds of designs and very ornate different things. And if you read the scriptures, you can find out exactly what those are. This won't cover all of what they were. But the tables for showbread were inside this holy place. Also, the golden incense. I showed you the... No, I didn't. Those were the lampstands. The golden incense thing is right there, and they burn a special incense before God. In fact, it's right in front of the veil, which shields that inner room. The veil hides that room from the rest of the building. The prayers are offered at the golden altar of incense. It was a special sweet incense required by God. The recipe was required by God of what they burned in it. The veil I mentioned in number eight. And if you know the New Testament story of the crucifixion, you would remember that during the storm or the darkness that when Jesus died, the veil was torn in Herod's temple. This is Solomon's temple, which was destroyed. We'll get into that in just a bit. But this one was destroyed. Herod built a temple 50 BC, something like that. And the veil in that temple, when Jesus died, was torn from top to bottom. And it was estimated to be a hand breadth thick of material, of cloth. Cloth woven a hand breadth thick, which wouldn't tear super easy, I'm thinking. It's like the people that can tear a phone book in half, you know? Like, you can't, because it's a lot of pages put together. Well, this cloth was the same way. And it was also torn from top to bottom in Jesus' day when he died. So that's the veil. The veil separated the holy place from the most holy place, where the Ark of the Covenant rested, separating a holy God from sinful people. Once a year, the high priest entered into this room, the Holy of Holies. Only once a year he could go in there. And there were rules about that. When he was in there, he had a rope on his leg and bells on his feet. Because if he was found unworthy, he would be struck dead. And no one could go get him, so they would pull him out. If the bells quit ringing, pull the guy out. I don't know if it ever happened, but that was part of the ritual of the temple. And number 9 is the most holy place, which I pointed out before. This is a tour, by the way, of Solomon's temple. The most holy place was God's throne room where he would meet and give his commands. You remember that from Exodus. Moses, he would speak to Moses from in there. Between the two cherubim, which are a type of angel, you can see their statues there. They're made of gold. And on the mercy seat over the Ark of the Covenant, and I think there's a picture right here of the Ark of the Covenant, if you can see it. And it has cherubim on that as well, that cover over the mercy seat is the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. And this is where God stayed, like right here, the cloud and the fire. You know, he came as in a cloud and a fire by night as he led the children of Israel out of Egypt. So once a year, the high priest would sprinkle blood on the mercy seat on the Day of Atonement. So it was a particular day of the year. There are 8 Jewish holidays. Day of Atonement is one of them. That one was the one where the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies. He would put blood on the mercy seat, and it was for the sins of the people for that year. That's the reason they did it. The cherubim were the big ones that the Ark of the Covenant was underneath. Even though there were cherubim here, there are some bigger ones that cover over the whole thing. And they were made out of olive wood and covered with gold or overlaid with gold. And they touched each other wingtip to wingtip, wall to wall. And cherubim is the angel that was sent to the Garden of Eden when man sinned to keep him out. There was a cherubim at the entrance to the garden, if you remember that. And he had a sword. Might have been a sword with fire on it. I'm not sure. But anyway, they weren't coming back in. So the Ark of the Covenant, we pointed that out. The Ark of the Covenant was a carved wooden box overlaid with gold. And if you have read before, you would remember what's in the Ark of the Covenant. But here, it's different. Do you remember what was in the Ark of the Covenant? Anybody remember? Manna was one, a jar of manna. Aaron's staff. And the Ten Commandments, the stone tablets. But you remember that before David got the Ark of the Covenant back, some other nation stole the Ark of the Covenant for 100 years. Do you remember that part, reading it in your Bible? Some other country came and stole the Ark of the Covenant. They said, ha-ha, this thing has power. I'm taking this box. So that another nation had it, and nobody went after it until David came along, and he went after it. Maybe that's why David was a man after God's own heart. I don't know. But evidently, those guys emptied it out. I don't know if they probably didn't see Raiders of the Lost Ark, the movie. Because in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when you open the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant, nobody survived. Stuff came out of there and ate your skin off and everything. So evidently, they didn't see the movie. But here in this account where Solomon has the temple built, the only thing inside the Ark of the Covenant were the stone tablets. So that's all that mentions anyway. So I'm assuming the other items were removed either by that other nation or Maybe the priests were instructed to take him out, but there's no record of when that happened. And then number 12 has storerooms in the back end, and that's all the stuff. That's not all the stuff that Solomon owned, but stuff that Solomon owned would be back there, like gold piles and stuff like that. I don't know how much gold they had left over, or if some of these materials went into some of the other houses that Solomon built. Like, he built one for himself, and I don't know if he built one for all of his wives. That'd be a lot of houses. But he did have other buildings built, a palace and things like that for him to live in. So that's the Rose Temple tour of Solomon's temple. I hope you found it interesting. I did. What do you do? You do that. So then, not only did Solomon accomplish building a house for God, but he was also esteemed as the wisest man, if you can imagine that. So I'm going to read a little bit to you from 1 Kings, maybe? 1 Kings 4. Just a couple verses. It goes Samuel, then Kings, right? I was trying to do it the other way, and it didn't work, so I changed the way I did it. 1 Kings 4, verses 29 through 34, it says this about Solomon and how young he was in his kingship. I don't know. It's hard for me to know. Verses 29 to 34, it says in chapter 4 of 1 Kings, "Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind, like the sand on the seashore." That's all the things that Solomon knew about items. Like, if you could count the sand, he knew that much. He knew that many different things. I don't even know how you say that. "Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt." And you know, Egypt built the pyramids, right? So Solomon could have done that because he was wiser than all the men. "His fame was known in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs and he wrote 1,005 songs." Not 1,006 or 1,004, 1,005 songs. "He spoke of trees," so this is some of the things he knew about, "from the cedar that was in Lebanon even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He spoke of animals and birds and creeping things and fish." So he knew a plethora of subjects well. "Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom from all the kings of the earth." So anybody that heard about him, somebody from that country came to find out about him because they, like, this can't be real. And if you knew the story of, what's the woman that came to visit him? The Queen of Sheba. She went there because she heard of him and she didn't believe it. And she came there to prove wrong whoever told her that he was wise. And she came and asked him questions, and he answered all of her questions, and she was amazed. And then she went home. How's that? Somebody came to test him out, a queen. So Solomon certainly shined in his glory, in the glory that he built in the temple, and he covered it with gold, and was first notch, top class the whole way, and also in his wisdom. There wasn't something that he couldn't figure out for you or tell you. I mentioned earlier that as a young person, I was confused about Solomon and his character, and that bothered me when I was a little kid, when I was Malachi's age. Did you know that on the wall of the temple, there are palm trees carved in, just like your shirt? I like that. I would have worn that shirt, except I didn't have one. But there are palm trees. It mentions the palm trees that were carved in all around on the walls and on the temple on the inside. So it did bother me when I was young. And this verse is next. Things were going great for Solomon. He was the king. He was the wisest guy in the world. He built the most magnificent building there ever could be. So King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom and in wisdom. What could be better? All the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his heart. They brought every man his gift, articles of silver. That's all he needed, was more silver and gold. He already had as much as this whole building put in silver and gold. And they keep bringing him more. And they brought him garments and weapons and spices and horses and mules. So much every year. Things were just great. And then all of a sudden, he had 700 wives, princes, and 300 princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. So when I was younger, that bothered me because I would think like this. How could such a wise man in the first place have 700 wives and 300 concubines? How hard would that be? I mean, how wise was this guy? He was like the wisest man, but 700 wives? Are you kidding me? He did. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And if you read the scriptures, those were his downfall. Can you imagine 700 wives and 300 concubines? Maybe he got too big for his britches. Is that a saying that you guys know? Well, if you're younger, it might be something like this. Maybe he was on an ego trip. Does that work? A little bit? No? Oh, no. I didn't go young enough. Can you imagine, though, 700 wives and 300 concubines, how much money Target would have made from the bridal registry? Can you imagine if there was only one Target in Jerusalem? You know that the bridal registry was there. 700 wives. If you marry one a day, it would be every day for 2 years straight you would have a wedding. Target's getting rich on this. If, I say if, because sometimes the wife might have come with a concubine, because what a concubine was a lesser wife. It was like a second-class wife or a slave, if you want to put it that way. It might be that some of the wives of the 700 had slaves that came with them, and they were the concubines. I'm not sure. But if they were on their own, 300 more would be another year of weddings. So it would be like he was king for 40 years. For 3 years, he had a wedding. How many toasters and blenders do you really need? I figure a lot of his wives were for political alliances. I know I was just joking a little bit about the wives, but still, the political alliance was important. It made peace in his kingdom, which he did have a kingdom of peace. But he followed after their gods and forsook his father David's God. And he turned his heart away from God. And as a result of turning his heart away from God, here's a little bit of a graph or a chart about Israel. What you have is the center up at the top where it says kings and prophets. Those are the three kings of Israel proper, the whole nation. And you'll notice Solomon is on the bottom of that, and then it divides into two columns because he couldn't hold the kingdom together once he got away from God. He could not hold it together anymore. So the kingdom split, and you have on your right Israel going down there, and you see down at the bottom of that first page, Israel stops. And you have Judah on the left. The nation is divided into two, but Judah continues on. These are timelines here. So around 710, Israel was taken over by Assyria. Assyria came and took them over. They're no longer even a thing. Judah lives on for another several hundred years, but 430 BC, Judah's taken over by Babylon. When Solomon lost the favor with God, the kingdom divided, he could not hold the kingdom together. This is kind of an interesting thing too. It shows the prophets in the middle as to where they were effective these different years. All these different prophets, where they fall in this area of time, and who were kings and who weren't kings. And in fact, quite a few of them, all these over here, there wasn't even an Israel, it was just Judah. So Israel was already gone. I just find that interesting. You might not, but I do. Hey, if you want something interesting, you preach. So, just kidding about that. So, when I was young, I always hoped that Solomon would turn back to God after he found out that all was vanity. After all, Ecclesiastes 3:1, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Wait, that might be 1:1. 3 is about, for everything there is a season. Ecclesiastes 1:1 is, all is vanity. He found out that things were all vanity. And I was hoping that he would come back and turn around. In Ecclesiastes 1:16 and 17, and this was part of his problem as well, I think, is that I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased in wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, or foolishness and righteousness, or just foolishness in there. And I realized that I was striving after the wind. So I can be the smartest man in the world, but it doesn't really matter. The last two verses of Ecclesiastes gave me a little bit of hope when I was Malachi's age for Solomon, thinking, this guy was so great, how can he stay down and not in favor with God? But at the end of Ecclesiastes, it says, the conclusion when all has been heard is, fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it's good or evil. God is the judge at the end. Doesn't really matter, because that's what's important. God is the judge at the end. Nothing else matters. The wisdom doesn't matter. The glory doesn't matter. The great building didn't matter that much. It seemed like Solomon had a roller coaster life, I thought. So some of us are moving on to advancing in schooling, or being advanced in schooling. Some of us are struggling with all the different things, some with financials, some with grief. Some of us are getting old and feeling it. Maybe I'm the only one in that boat. But all of us struggle with something, causing anxiety or fear or worry. And I wanted to close with this thought and words from Jesus, our preacher. It's out of the Sermon on the Mount, or it's from the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6. He has a little bit to say about what's important, what's not important. Matthew 6, verses 25 to the end of the chapter 34. I'm going to read it to you. And then we're going to close in a song, which Malachi is going to play. So verse 25 of Matthew 6. For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life, as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body or what you will put on. Is not life more than food and body, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They do not reap or sow or gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? I think it's talking about our faith in God, using the creation. And who of you, being worried, can even add a single hour to your life or a minute? The worry doesn't change anything. Why then are you worried about your clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They don't either spin or toil. They don't work at all, the flowers in the field. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all of his glory clothed himself like one of these. So even the greatness that Solomon had wasn't as good as a simple flower that God created. But God, in verse 30, but if God is so clothed the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing, or how am I going to get money to pay this bill? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things, for your heavenly Father knows what you need. He knows that you need all these things. In verse 33, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, then all these things will be added to you. So it's a priority as to how we should live our lives, which Solomon did for a while, but he went away from it. So that's kind of like it was a lesson that I saw as a kid that bothered me, that how could someone so wise fall so hard? Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. I think that's says enough. So Malachi is going to play Seek Ye First. He's learning it. So